Garrison, welcome to the New Diplomatist Podcast. As always, I am your host, and today I am very honored to be joined by Dr. Patrick Holden, Associate Professor from the University of Plymouth in the United Kingdom. Dr. Holden, it is an honor to have you back on the New Diplomatist Podcast.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Now, sir, for those who may not have caught our last episode in late 2020, would you be willing to give a brief refresher to some of your expertise and the work that you do at University of Plymouth?
Sure. So I'm an expert mainly in international political economy and public policy, including trade policy and development policy, mostly focusing on Europe and the European Union, originally very much European Union and developing countries in the Middle East and Africa. But like many people, I became very interested in Brexit and its implications for the UK and Ireland. I should say I'm Irish myself, so that gives a certain perspective as well, but I try to be fair in analysing these things.
The main reason I asked you on today was to give us sort of an update as to how things were going with Northern Ireland, particularly in relation to the Northern Ireland Protocol, which has obviously been a big news topic. And then later we can work towards discussing the G7, which was recently held not too far from where you're at in Cornwall. But first, starting with Brexit and the fallout, we are, you know, 6-7 months in now from that end of 2020 trade negotiations. We are slowly but surely working our way, it would seem, out of the pandemic. What's the mood currently, would you say, in the general public regarding Brexit and 7 months in, coming out of the pandemic, starting to take a peek at normalcy? How do people feel about it?
Well, with the United Kingdom as a whole, well, people have accepted that Brexit has happened and there's no easy way back to the EU. It's been somewhat overshadowed by COVID-19, obviously, because this is such an epic crisis. And the government is currently doing quite well in the polls, mainly, I think, because it's handled the vaccine program well, and people are thinking that they see the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's summertime, and people are relatively positive. A lot of the problems predicted in regard to Brexit and the UK's disconnection from the European Union have happened and are happening if you listen to business and various other stakeholders. In the public at large, I don't think there's a great sense of discontent about Brexit at the moment. This could well build over time because it has created quite a few problems.
One of those topics of discussion that seems to be fairly perennial, at least from my perspective on this side of the Atlantic, has been the Northern Ireland Protocol, which was a mechanism that came into force January 1st this year, now part of international law, to try and maintain the peace that was first established under the Good Friday Agreement between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and in particular, trying to do the utmost of all parties to avoid a hard border between the border of the United Kingdom at Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. 7 months on from that coming into force, how would you say that the Northern Ireland Protocol is functioning, and what's sort of the status of it at this point?
It's functioning, although as I would have expected, it's very controversial, especially with the unionists, those in Northern Ireland that are very keen on maintaining the link with the rest of the UK, are understandably very upset by it. I think it's worth explaining a little bit of the background. So the UK was in the EU, which is, amongst other things, a customs union and a kind of regulatory union as well. We call it economic integration. Once the UK left and also decided to leave all these legal arrangements, there was bound to be some kind of more extensive international trade border between the UK and the rest of the EU. What this meant in particular on the island of Ireland is that there was either going to have to be a border on the land border between Northern Ireland and the rest of Ireland, or within the UK between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And there was essentially a big, very tough set of negotiations and a power struggle, albeit a non-violent one, for quite a few years between Ireland and the EU and the UK government working out how that would be resolved. They agreed, this was the withdrawal agreement back in the autumn of 2019. Boris Johnson, who had recently become Prime Minister, surprised many people by agreeing to this Northern Ireland Protocol. And now, to cut a long story short, it had some face-saving elements, and it did maintain the access of Northern Ireland to Great Britain and the rest of the UK, but it did effectively put a trade barrier in between England, Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, because there were going to be all kinds of checks and procedures at Northern Irish ports. And these are the kind of checks that are common international frontier, including checks on rules of origin, where products are from, their standards, particularly, as your listeners might be aware, anything to do with agriculture and agri-food is very rigorously checked in many countries, including the EU bloc, are quite protectionist in many senses of the word about that, rightly or not. The UK government agreed this protocol back in the autumn of 2019. How exactly it would work, though, was going to very much be shaped by the broader trade agreement that the UK reached with the EU, and that was happening in 2020. And the key fact here is that although they managed to agree to not put on tariffs on goods, as in basic taxes on goods entering a country, it was in other respects a relatively light economic agreement compared to what had been the case for the UK. It didn't have strong regulatory alignment or services or in particular alignment on agricultural and environmental issues. So this meant that the trade frontier was going to be quite strong, because the situation that the UK government got itself into was, however much they diverged from the rest of the EU, then because Northern Ireland was essentially staying inside the EU's customs and regulatory area, there was going to be a greater border between the rest of Great Britain and Northern Ireland because of that. There's quite a few arguments to be had about whether this is right or wrong, and Northern Ireland unionists in particular were very angry because, to put it bluntly, the UK Prime Minister betrayed them. He frankly encouraged them to help get rid of the previous Prime Minister, who was going to separate Northern Ireland a little but not a great deal in her deal. Boris persuaded them to reject that, but he then agreed, once you look at the detail of it, much more radical disconnect of Northern Ireland from the United Kingdom. And that's clearly a great psychological blow to unionists, and also it's a practical problem in many respects as well. It was all done very quickly as well. This trade agreement was done in a year, and it was, I mean, businesses in the UK had only a few days to prepare for this really radical transformation in relations with the EU. The most obvious things I think people noticed was that quite an extensive series of checks on all kinds of products, particularly anything to do with agriculture or the natural world, even though some provisions of it haven't even been fully implemented yet. People found that, say, buying potted plants or something like that wasn't possible. Supermarkets are finding it very difficult because, you know, say supermarkets will transport goods within the same country, obviously not how you would do an international trade deal. They'll just put just a lot of different stuff on trucks and so on, whereas that's not usually how you would do it across an international trade frontier. You would have more, you know, generic, this is a truck of furniture, whatever it is. And of course it's quite strange and hard for people to accept, because this is the same state, the United Kingdom, but there's quite a deep border now between them. Now this border is actually enforced by the UK government. It's not like, you know, EU administrators there, although they're keeping an eye on it. So it's quite an odd arrangement. It's worth noting, from the EU's perspective, they're actually being generous to Northern Ireland, they think, because Northern Ireland can have free access to both markets, both the UK and the rest of the EU. And also, they have a frontier of, you know, that's to be managed for 27 countries, over 450 million people, and they're letting the UK government do that. When they designed a protocol, they had all kinds of ideas about a risk-based approach and, you know, trusted traders, so that you wouldn't absolutely have to check everything, like, say, a Chinese ship just arriving in a port in Rotterdam or something like that. But the EU says that the UK government hasn't yet provided all the data and means to do that, so at the moment they're insisting on these very rigorous checks. This is the source of a lot of anger in the unionist community. The unionist political parties, in particular the main one, the Democratic Unionist Party, has gone into a bit of a tailspin in that it's been completely outmaneuvered by Ireland and the EU and the British government to have been put in this situation. It's trying to rail against it, but it doesn't really have that much leverage to try and get rid of it. more generally, there are more, shall we say, vigorous protests, and that from elements of the unionist community, including people connected with paramilitaries and so on, that are furious about this. And there have been some riots, and next month, for people who know Northern Ireland would know, it is a very, very important month with parades from those of the unionist tradition on the 12th of July and so on. And there can often be political tension around that. That's the situation we're in at the moment.
Lots to keep track of there in Northern Ireland. We appreciate your insights on that. We know our listeners will be watching that carefully in the months ahead to see how this plays out. But I do want to touch on one more thing before I let you go, sir, which would be a couple quick questions on the G7. It's just recently held in Cornwall. And there were several rather large announcements coming out of that meeting that grabbed some global headlines, one of them being 1 billion COVID vaccine dose pledge for poorer nations. But also, perhaps more interesting, or perhaps controversial, depending on who you ask, the group of seven countries agreed to back a new global minimum tax rate of at least 15% that companies would have to pay regardless of where they locate their headquarters. Now, that marks an interesting departure, does it not, particularly for some European Union countries such as Ireland, who have received flack for being, you know, so-called tax havens or playing the rules there a little bit. How is that received, in your view, within the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland? And do you think that that changes economic dynamics going forward?
Yeah, well, definitely symbolically, it's a very important move. Like you suggested, it's really a big change from how the world had been working for decades, where tax competition of different types was a driving dynamic and everybody's competing to attract these transnational companies. And these were, you know, the major democratic capitalist economies at least saying we're going to put a floor under it. It's generally regarded as a kind of triumph for the Biden administration, even though that major European countries like France and Germany had been supporting this for a long time, but it was the Americans coming on board with it that helped persuade the UK. Very interesting from the UK's point of view, by the way, because they've been talking a lot about sovereignty and sometimes giving the impression that they wouldn't agree, like any international treaty, constrain them in any way, whereas theoretically at least agreeing to have a, you know, minimum to the tax you're able to charge is quite a big concession, maybe more of a sovereignty issue than most EU law. The general reaction, of course, is that the devil is in the detail and how is this going to work in particular. You know, how are you going to exactly calculate the profits and so on? This information is absolutely key. Of course, it's got to be kind of passed on to other countries as well, such as major G20 countries and so on. But it seems that the G7 have the economic heft to do it if they really want to. The EU itself is divided, so it's an interesting issue for the EU. These big countries, France, Germany and Italy, are very, very happy with this. The smaller ones like Ireland and countries like Romania, Bulgaria, that have quite low tax rates as well. I think probably in Ireland's case, they'll have to go along with it in principle because they've been avoiding this within the EU and saying that, oh, we need to get the Americans and others involved as well. But now the Americans and others are involved. So I think they'll accept it, but argue about that still quite a lot of flexibility is needed. I mean, they have a point that small countries need to offer something to be able to compete with large, very populous countries. Personally, I think it's a positive step, a great deal to be worked out about how it would work.
Do you feel going forward that this will be something that unifies economic stability to a degree? I know it's in a limited sense taxation. It doesn't control, you know, fiscal or monetary spending. But in the sense that, does that stabilize Europe's outlook in terms of where businesses will be moving to, where they'll, you know, conduct their operations and so on? Or do you feel that it might open the door to a continuation of the narrative, sometimes pushed by European populists in particular, that there's a two-track Europe and that there's a set of policies that work for the big economies and a set of policies that don't work so well for some of the more developing countries, particularly on the eastern side of the continent, that might be left behind because, like you said, they lose a point of leverage with which to attract business?
One of the tensions there is in the EU is between small countries and larger ones. And what's the balance between, okay, we give away some powers, but we get access and we retain flexibility to do things. So I could see some tensions there. You know, some of the countries in the EU that, for example, are seen as very aggressive, people aggressively helping companies avoid tax, are countries like the Netherlands and Luxembourg. Actually don't have their headline rate isn't very low. It's just that they have all these other legal mechanisms, so that's going to be something that there'll be a lot to negotiate for. I don't see it as the biggest issue for the EU. It's going to lead to things being a bit spiky between smaller countries and wealthier ones, but compared to things like the management of the Eurozone and migration crisis, that's really the big issue for tensions within the EU.
Absolutely. And as a final question for the day, as a resident of the United Kingdom yourself and working in the academic field, what's your perspective on the Group of Seven Summit, the first major international meeting to be hosted within Britain when it's fully exited into this new Brexit phase of its existence again? One of the first in-person meetings we've had since, I would say, late 2019, possibly the very opening months and weeks of 2020 because of COVID. How do you feel it came off for Boris Johnson's government and for United Kingdom as a whole in this new independent global Britain mindset?
Well, it was good to see, and it certainly showcased Cornwall, which is a beautiful part of the world, very well. I think quite a few people were hoping to put all issues about the EU behind them, but they might have forgotten that not only are there three EU states, like France, Germany and Italy, but also the EU leadership, the Commission President and the Council President are there as well.
Yes.
So I think quite a few people had forgotten that and were quite dismayed. The G7 is obviously no longer exactly the commanding heights of the world economy as it would have been in the 1970s. Still the major capitalist democracies, and it's certainly worthwhile for them to meet and coordinate. And in Cornwall, they did invite leader of India and the leaders of Australia and South Korea as well. But obviously, if we are talking about truly global, you know, concert of powers or something like that, you have to have some of these G20 countries like China involved as well. I think it still serves a function for democracies to coordinate together and agree some policies.
So thank you very much for coming back on the New Diplomatist podcast to discuss all things Northern Ireland, as well as updates regarding the G7 summit and the outlook for Britain as it continues to navigate where things are very much shifting due to COVID and so on. We do appreciate your expertise. We appreciate your time. And thank you very much for coming on the New Diplomatist podcast.
Thanks, Carson. Enjoyed it.